He ain't gonna do shit.
Blog Talk Radio.
Mama.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon. I will be joined in a few moments by co-host Peter Fowler, who is on the road in parts unknown somewhere within the stolen borders of the empire, otherwise known as the United States of America. And also be having a guest calling from New York City, a comrade. Her name is Maria, and she'll be calling in from New York City, and she's originally from Colombia. And we'll have some things to talk about, some about the hypocrisy that exists within these stolen borders of the United States of America, the so-called United States of America, or the un-United States of America. And she'll be talking about the U.S. foreign policy in Colombia, you know, as has to do with the past administration of Uribe, who is a fascist dictator, murderous dictator, who had a lot of blood on his hands. And continually, the U.S. administration, whether it was Bush or even the Obama administration, supported him lock, stock, and barrel, as well as the incoming administration of Santos. And so we'll be talking some things about that and comparing and contrasting the U.S. coverage and of various South American governments, especially when you look at even just juxtaposing Colombia and Venezuela. But there's a lot of things what we're going to get into today. We're going to cover some news and some Black Agenda Report clips. And but the theme today, this being July 5th, the day after Independence Day, the day after where you could drive through pretty much any municipality or hamlet throughout the U.S. and find some kind of celebration, some kind of parade and fireworks, you know, soon thereafter, and the red, white, and blue flying everywhere, you know, celebrating the independence, the independence, Independence Day, and you patriotic, you got to be patriotic on that day. You have to get out there, you have to talk, you have to, sing the songs, God Bless America, or hear the songs, you know, at these different fireworks events, and just get you rallied up to be proud to be an American, and all the things that go along with it, you know, the freedom and justice for all, and the independence. Oh yes. Well, not so fast, my friend, not so fast. This episode, we're going to be talking about the hypocrisies of the 4th of July, Independence Day. I mean, and we have to remember, it was in 1852, on this very day, July 5th, the day after the 4th of July, that the great Frederick Douglass gave his impassioned speech, and we'll take a snippet into that. We'll cover a little bit of that during this show. But, I invite all of you to call in. And once again, the call-in number is 347-945-5191. Once again, it's 347-945-5191. And so without further ado, I'm going to have Peter come on. I just see that Peter has joined us, and I also see that Maria has joined us. And so ladies first, so I'll go to Maria first. Maria, I see that you're on air right now in Your World News, and it's a pleasure to have you. If you can just give us and the thousands of listeners of Your World News a couple tidbits on who you are and what does the 4th of July mean to you? What does the 4th of July mean to you? Because I believe you have dual citizenship now. So what is it? Are you proud to be American? What does it mean to you?
Okay, well, thanks for having me on the show, Solomon. Yes, I do have dual citizenship. And, you know, as I've mentioned before, it's just very difficult to accept, being part of what we call the United States of America, especially coming from a country that has been so affected in a terrible and negative way by this country. I guess I'll just go into exactly how I feel and the hypocrisy of the United States. Something that I really find when I talk to a lot of people, that they have no idea what the Schools of America is, which I think is something critical, not just to Colombia, but countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America in general. Just to mention briefly what it is, it started out in Panama as a school where the U.S. trained right-wing military personnel from different Latin American countries or African or Asian countries. And then they moved it to the United States, so it's in Fort Benning, Georgia. It continues today, but they changed the name in order to disguise their practices, because there was multiple organizations that rose up from it, one in particular called the Schools of America's Watch, who does a lot of research on their manuals, which specifically teach torture techniques and tactics. And and to speak specifically about Colombia, they receive, I believe in Latin America at least, they've received the most graduates from the Schools of America. You can trace a lot of the dictators from different countries to the Schools of America. So the fact that the United States even has a school like this is ridiculous. I mean, the fact you know, if any other country in the world had a school like that, it would immediately be called a terrorist organization, which the Schools of America is, but they would never call that here. And I guess on the same topic, Colombia is the third largest recipient of U.S. aid after Israel and Egypt. So it's military aid, and it's not money that goes into, you know, social education programs by any means. It's majority military funding. And to me, people talk about this war on drugs and how it's aiding and helping and eradicating cocaine production, and, you know, and it hasn't gone down. I mean, that's a fact. That's not someone, you know, with a conspiracy theory. It's truth. But besides that, to me, it's like a business deal. Like, the U.S. gives the Colombian military money, and then in return, the military spends that on U.S. corporations that sell them helicopters, guns, uniforms. So it's not in any way about, you know, and also what they spray on the coca fields.
I don't know if it's DDT.
Right. That's all bought from U.S. corporations. So it's essentially a business deal. It's not like they're, it's not anything else than a business deal. They're not eradicating, you know, all the research shows that cocaine production has gone up, consumption in the United States has gone up. There's no prevention programs in Colombia or in the United States. And then, you know, to tie that in with other forms of U.S., you know, covert and overt involvement in Colombia, there's the paramilitaries, which, you know, started up as another form of military movement in Colombia that's right-wing, you know, and that's heavily funded by the U.S., that has a lot of ties to government officials like Uribe and, you know, a lot of people that he's close to in the government, but also U.S. corporations like Chiquita and Coca-Cola, who are notorious for killing trade union organizers, and not even to mention that the fact that Colombia has the highest rate of killing union organizers in the world right now.
Right. So we have a lot to dissect, and I appreciate you mentioning all of that. And you're right. You know, for those of you guys who don't know, the School of America is very, very nefarious organization, and now they are under the name of the Western Hemisphere Institute of Security and Cooperation. They try to be slick, kind of like a pull, like a Blackwater move, where Blackwater pulled a move like they did, and you know, where they changed their name to XEZ, you know, because there was so much bad publicity out there. So that's Western Hemisphere Institute of Security Cooperation, and I think it's really important that folks go, as Maria said, that you go to School of America's Watch. You can just go to www.soaw.org. That's www.soaw.org. That's School of America's Watch. And before I introduce Peter, I'm going to get Peter's take, because I know he's going to have some really important things to say in his intro as we, you know, vanguard throughout this the next hour and 15 minutes, you know, looking at, taking a critical look at America, the hypocrisy behind it, and you know, the vast amount of potential that continues to go underserved because America continues to be controlled by and large corporations, because America continues to be a country that has institutional racism and white supremacy running deep through its veins. And so because of that, and it's an imperial power, it's a warmongering state, just like, you know, just like Rome was, and as we know from history, Rome eventually fell. You know, so if we really want to see, those of you guys that are really uber patriotic, the best way I think you can be patriotic is to recognize the flaws within your home, and then clean the hell out of that home. You need to clean it up, and you can't clean up if you don't know about it. If you're unwilling to speak on the leaks and the potholes and the funk that's coming, that is, you know, within the roads or within the, you know, just the infrastructure of the home that you're living in. You know, there has to be some kind of knowledge, and then within that knowledge, you have to be willing to do what it takes to bring attention to it and then therefore clean it up. And so as Frederick Douglass did in 1852, I'm going to read this just not the whole thing, obviously, but I just want to read this brief passage from the speech that Frederick Douglass gave in Rochester, New York on July 5th, 1852. And tell me, those of us who are awake, those of us who have taken that blue pill, tell me that this is not so apropos for 2010 and the country that we're living in right now, known as America. And this is what he said. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity, your sound of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants brass-fronted impudence, your shout of liberty and equality, hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. I think that is so powerful. That is so powerful, and you cannot tell me. So those of us that are conscious, those of us who come from demographics that are historically oppressed and marginalized and brutalized, it should come as no secret why individuals like myself and many, many, many others refuse to celebrate the 4th of July until there is that proverbial level playing field, until there is no longer an absence of justice within our communities across the board. And I thought it was so apropos what Frederick Douglass said when he said these crimes would disgrace a nation of savages. But there is a lack of disgrace here because I guess this nation is filled with folks that are beneath the term or the label, the moniker of a savage. So without further ado, our intrepid co-host, Peter Fowler, joining us from somewhere in the United States of America. I know it's not Arizona. Peter, are you with us?
Yes, I'm right here, Solomon.
Okay.
Always good to be with you, bro.
All right, good to have you. Good to have you. So if you can give us your intro before we go to the Black Agenda Report first clip, what is Independence Day? What does it mean to you? What has it meant to you? And I guess how have you evolved? And I'm assuming, you know, just me knowing you personally and your politics, I know that it's kind of a repugnant, hypocritical day for you. But if you can, in your own words, let our listeners know what 4th of July means to you and why.
Indeed. Also want to say hello to Maria. Good to have you on the show with us, Maria.
And Pete, if you can speak up a little bit. We can't hear you. If you can speak up a little bit.
All right. The 4th of July, you know, and it's so appropriate. I'm glad we're doing the show on the 5th of July today because I like the resonance with Frederick Douglass, and the reason that he gave that quote on July 5th of 1852 because he refused to participate in his local community's July 4th celebration and observation. And he said, I'll only speak at your event if we do it on a day other than the 4th. And they moved the celebration to the 5th of July because he refused to even observe the 4th and participate in any observations that would give any kind of validity to the fraud and the deception and the mockery that he was talking about. So it's very appropriate, and I'm glad we're doing this show on July 5th, 2010. And as I look at the Independence Day holiday, it is indeed a lot of fraud, deception, and hollow mockery of the ideals that are proclaimed by the so-called founders of the nation, and that are in the founding documents of this country. And when we talk about Frederick Douglass and his denunciation of this holiday and this observation of freedom as it's proclaimed, you know, a lot of people might say, well, we don't have slavery in this country any longer. But think of the system that needed slavery, the system that functioned with slavery, and it's the system of capitalism, and it was capitalism and nationalism and militarism that drove this country in its early days to slavery, institutionalized chattel slavery for hundreds of years on this continent. And that system still exists today. That system has not changed. The ideals and the needs and the agendas of imperialism and capitalism and militarism are still alive and well, and I would go so far as to say even more so than they were in 1852, when from where Frederick Douglass is speaking to us today. So you know the same indignation and angst that Frederick Douglass expressed in 1852 is something I resonate with, and I know you resonate with, and others of us who reject this kind of bombastic holiday. We feel the same things Frederick Douglass felt, or similar feelings, certainly. And I look at the Independence Day holiday, and I see the same kind of hypocrisy, and some of the things that trouble me, and I want to get into these as the show moves forward, Solomon, is the conflation of nationalism and Christianity. And as you know, particularly my area of expertise as a critical theorist, I want to look at theology in American Christianity. And so today is a perfect opportunity to look at the role of religion in propping up the systems of oppression and exploitation. So that marriage of nationalism and Christianity in particular in this country helps to prop up this holiday and the myth of democracy and the myth of the American dream. And so when I look at the 4th of July, you know, I don't think of independence. I don't think of, you know, a great nation and all the other bombast that people use when referring to this country. But need to look at it very frankly, very honestly. And this will be the last thing I say before we move forward. Just reading today some data on just some polls taken, and folks were being asked what country did the United States gain its independence from back in the 18th century. And 68% of young adults did not know from which country the United States colonies gained their independence and became the United States of America. That's 32% of young Americans have no idea that it was Britain that this country derived
from. Some people say
6% of the respondents said China.
Yeah.
6%. Yeah. I mean, and a number of other countries, France and Mexico.
Exactly.
Right. And so, you know, so the ignorance of the American population is instructive, because I want to contrast that with a quote from one of the so-called founding fathers. You know, George Washington, the first president and the general of the Continental Army. He said this. He said, "Knowledge in every country is the surest basis of public happiness." And he goes on from there. "But knowledge in every country is the surest basis of public happiness." And if we look at why this lack of knowledge to the point of ignorance, that some of the answers that people gave in that poll about American history, and it's no mistake that people don't have basic fundamental knowledge to not only be good citizens of this country, but to be good citizens of the world. And it's no mistake, because of the system of public education in this country, is not designed to make people critical thinkers, is not designed to make people well-informed and active citizens. And, you know, it's no mistake. It is part of the breakdown of civility in this country, the way that public education is being undermined. So I thought that was a fitting way to start off the afternoon, just looking at some interesting quotes from some of the so-called founding fathers, and I hope that we do get a chance to talk a little later about the conflation of nationalism and Christianity.
I think that would be definitely appropriate, given the fact that we're supposed to be living in a nation that within its own constitution said that there's supposed to be a separation of church and state, but we know that that's we know that that's not the case. Every day, millions, tens of millions of youth are asked to speak, or not speak, I should say, get up and place their hand over their heart and to recite something that says, you know, I'm actually kind of proud. I can't remember everything, but one nation under God, one nation under God. And we see candidates from both sides of the aisle using, you know, religion as a tool to garner votes and even justification in terms of giving an insight in terms of how they might govern. You know, just like that nitwit. I can't remember her first name, but the woman running for Congress in Arizona, I believe it's Congress, she is running for Congress in Arizona, and or is it Nevada? I can't remember. I can't remember if it's Nevada or Arizona. I'll look it up in a second. But her last name is Engel, and when asked about abortion, she basically said that. That, you know, even in the instances of rape and incest, that abortion should not be allowed because we should leave it to God to intercede. That it's within the will of God to intercede. So basically, I mean, using her argument, I mean, she's basically also saying that, you know, it was God's will that, you know, that allowed that rape, you know, to take place. You know, and it's just sick that, and she was wide open to this. I mean, she was on a radio show that was conservative leaning and with no mention of words whatsoever. I mean, she said that. And so, and she's not the only one. She is definitely not a novel act. There are a lot of religious zealots that walk the halls of Congress each and every single day, whether in the Senate or in the House of Representatives. So, Pete, I definitely think that we should, you know, before the end of the show, dissect, look at the conflation of religion and comparing it to so many different vehicles and apparatus within the United States of America, this United States of America. And, Peter, you said American dream, the so-called American dream. And I think this would be a very apropos soundbite to play when we talk about the American dream and why, Peter, and why, Maria, is this message right here, this timely message, you know, over 40 years of old, why is not this message out there? It's a bit of a rhetorical question.
Being here in America doesn't make you an American. Being born here in America doesn't make you an American. Why, if birth made you American, you wouldn't need any legislation. You wouldn't need any amendments to the Constitution. No, I'm not an American. I'm one of the 22 million black people who are the victims of Americanism. One of the 22 million black people who are the victims of democracy. Nothing but disguised hypocrisy. And I see America through the eyes of a victim. I don't see any American dream. I see an American nightmare.
Supposed to be off the street by 10 o'clock. If we shoot, we're going to shoot to kill.
There's been a lot of talk said recently because I was supposed to have said something about Negroes should buy rifles. White people have been buying rifles all their life. No commotion.
Shut it off and get out of that car with your hand up. All of you, the one in the back seat, too.
Come on, get up.
Get your hands up, I said. Drop that first and get your hands up.
You can lift them higher than that, Bram. Let's get them up there. First one drops your hands, is dead, man.
Fighting in Vietnam. Come home and look what happened to me.
You move them.
We are peaceful people.
We're loving people. We love everybody who loves us. But we don't love anybody who doesn't love us. We're nonviolent with people who are nonviolent with us. But we are not nonviolent with anyone who is violent with us. Here he is standing up in front of other people, Uncle Sam, with the blood of your and my mothers and fathers on his hands, with the blood dripping down his jaws like a bloody jawed wolf. No more days like those. I pray that God will bless you in everything that you do. I pray that you will grow intellectually so that you can understand the problems of the world and where you fit into in that world picture. And I pray that all the fear that has ever been in your heart will be taken out. And when you look at that man, if you know he's nothing but a coward, you won't fear him. If he wasn't a coward, he wouldn't gang up on you. This is how they function. They function in mobs. That's a coward. They put on a sheet so you won't know who they are. That's a coward. No. The time will come when that sheet will be ripped off. If the federal government doesn't take it off, we'll take it off.
So, yes, that was the prophet, Malcolm X, and I just thought that was appropriate when he said that, you know, this is not an American dream. This is an American nightmare. And the nitwit I was talking about, the lady that's running for a U.S. Senate, it's actually in Nevada, and she's running against Harry Reid. Her name is Sharon Angle. You can just go to SharonAngle.com. But, yeah, she's fully, she's a full-fledged right-wing fascist, you know, probably, you know, without a doubt, closet racist. I mean, she's all that, you know, in a bag of chips. And so, you know, definitely if you type in her name, Sharon Angle, for Congress, and you should get the YouTube clip that has her radio interview talking about abortion, or just type in Sharon Angle abortion. It should be out there. That's what we do here on Your World News. We don't hide from the facts. We try to engage our listeners the same way our listeners engage us to look things up for ourselves. It's important that we look things up for ourselves and we cross-reference. So, Peter, I know you have a great deal of deference to the great El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, otherwise known as Malcolm X, and have, you know, mentioned him a few times on our show about Malcolm being mentioned in the same light of a prophet, the same way that Jesus is mentioned as a prophet. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit, Pete? And then, Maria, I'd like to get your take on that as well.
Absolutely. I do. Definitely, Malcolm X stands in the esteemed tradition of the biblical prophet. And we can go all the way back to the 8th century prophets we read about in the Hebrew Bible, Isaiah, Micah, Amos, many of the others that are mentioned in the Bible, as well as the writing prophets. We move forward in time, and we can fast forward to the 20th century. And certainly, we must include Malcolm X in that conversation and in that tradition. And, you know, it's often talked about how Martin Luther King was the great 20th century American prophet, and yet still Malcolm is left out of that conversation. And it's only because he has been left out of that conversation that we have to talk about him and reinsert him into that conversation, because most Americans do not want to address, face, or even accept the fact that Malcolm said the things that he said, because he did speak like a prophet. He spoke the truth, and he spoke the truth to power, and he spoke the truth to powerlessness. He spoke the truth to everyday people. He spoke the truth wherever he was, to whomever was in his audience. And he spoke the truth about America. And in that clip, we hear one of my favorite clips of all time is that one right there. And the way he breaks down America, not as an American dream, but as an American nightmare. And he realizes that because he lived the American nightmare, as many, many of us do. Millions of people in this country don't see an American dream, but an American nightmare. And it's that kind of a hermeneutic. It's that kind of a interpretation, a method of interpretation, and a perspective on this country that allowed Malcolm to have that perspective and come to those conclusions, and then to be able to articulate it in a way that no one else could. So absolutely, we have to include Malcolm in the tradition, and that is one of the reasons why that particular clip, when he talked about the American dream being a myth and a fraud being perpetrated on the American people, that we are, you know, essentially sleepwalking, chasing this myth of American dream that does not exist for the majority of people, and it will never come to fruition, no matter how hard we work and, you know, try to pull us up by our bootstraps and all that claptrap that is part of that mythology. And for most of us, those things will never be realized. So, you know, Malcolm had the strength and the audacity to say it, and he had the magical oratory to say it in such a way that we can't not address it. We can't not deal with it. But so much of America doesn't want to hear that, and particularly, you know, Christian America. America as a Christian nation, and Malcolm being part of the Nation of Islam, and then later on his own independent form of Islam. You know, Americans don't want to deal with folks who are Islamic. And so another reason why Malcolm's been cut out of the conversation. But we need to continue to hold him up, reinsert him in that conversation, and lift him up as a prophet and hear his voice, not as a character in history, but as a prophet who speaks in a timeless fashion, and his words still speak to us today. So absolutely, Malcolm's a prophet, and we need to hear him, and this is a great time of year to hear the words of Malcolm X, the American prophet, speak out about the truth about America.
Right, yeah, without a doubt. Maria, I know that you were born in Colombia, and you left, I believe it was Bogota, Colombia, at a young age, and I know that you go back still on a very frequently, and so you're still very much in tune with the politics that impact Colombia within and as well as without, outside of Colombia, you know, internally and externally, as I should have said. What do you think about, and what do you think about this American dream? Because usually on TV, you know, when we see, you know, various Latinos, when they put a mic in front of their face, or even somebody else from some other part of the world, they'll find the ones that will say, "Oh, America been very, very good to me," you know, wherever they're from, you know, that America's been so, so great. But that's not always, that's not usually the case. I mean, the tens of millions of immigrants that are within the U.S., whether they may be from Colombia or Mexico or El Salvador or Sudan or Ethiopia, their stories, the tens of millions, I mean, their stories are often not told. Those are the ones that, when you look at even the case of folks like Amadou Diallo, you know, who was from Guinea, you know, and, you know, his, I don't think when he came to the U.S., his American dream had an ending of him getting hailed with over 40 bullets and being brought to his death simply based on the fact that he was a black man. And because he was black, he must have been reaching for a gun and not his wallet, and his life came to a quick end. So I want to ask you about what is the American dream to you, and you know, just having conversations with you off air. I know there's somebody that you have garnered a lot of respect for, was the great Ernesto Che Guevara, and I mentioned him in the same vein of Malcolm X, because he was brought to his end at a very early age as well. I believe 39 as well. And so, if you can give us a couple of your words.
Well, I think Malcolm said it best. I hadn't heard it that way before. It's not, you know, it is an American nightmare. I think that when I do go back to Colombia, and I mean, we can even see how the United States uses propaganda within the U.S., but, you know, you see it a lot outside of the U.S. as well. Like, you watch any American movies or TV shows, and it's just like, as if anyone can just come here and attain, you know, all these materialistic things. That's what's sold to you. And I just think it's interesting that people in the United States, with this whole immigration issue, believe that, you know, people watch these movies and then that's the only reason that they want to come here, like, because they're going to be able to attain, you know, a nice car or a nice house. Like, of course, if you're in a position where you're struggling day to day to make ends meet in another country, like, that might be appealing, but there's, you know, much larger forces which drive people to come here. You know, being internally displaced within your own country and then being forced outside of your country because of, you know, economic and military policies against your country are the real roots of immigration to this nation. And then, you know, once something that I've seen a lot within the Latino community and other immigrant communities is once families are here, a lot of people want to believe in that they can attain this American dream. And I hear so much discourse towards Latino youth about attaining this American dream, having the nice car and the house with the picket fence and, you know, two kids. And I just don't understand, you know, why we're not talking about how Malcolm said it. It's not a dream. It's a nightmare. The fact that you have to leave your country, leave your entire family, and then once you're here, you know, all you hear is you need to assimilate, you need to acculturate, you need to accept this imposition of white hegemony on you, like, and that's the only way you're going to survive, that's the only way that you're going to get anywhere, and that's what I see so much with successful Latino and, you know, black or other immigrant communities. It's just, it's sad. I don't think that, you know, that should be the way we're approaching it, you know, speaking the truth, like Malcolm said in this speech, and talking about it as a nightmare, and you know, the exploitation that our families have to endure in, you know, our countries of origin, and then once you get to the U.S., you know, where you're just completely worthless and just through labor and in school the way you're treated, we never discuss those issues and how that is a nightmare. It's exactly that. It's not a dream at all. And most of the people, you know, in our communities don't attain this quote-unquote dream. And when they do, they forget about where they came from. There's no, like, bringing our communities together to create real change.
And that's a good point that you bring up, Maria. An excellent point that you bring up is that when you touched on that when you're an immigrant, you know, coming from another country, especially an immigrant of color, brown or black, there is this tremendous pressure to assimilate. And as you assimilate, as you know, psychologists, you know, from Frantz Fanon to so many others have done research around in the past, is that the oppressed, you know, systematically, oftentimes they will take upon the idiosyncrasies and actions and ideologies as of their oppressor, and in this case, you know, so people may not be, you know, may not be shackled, but then that's another conversation. When we look at the prison industrial complex, so many. You know, are shackled, you know, in similar chains of shadow slavery, but here it's that those folks that are coming in, the brown and black skinned immigrants, and even those who are not, I mean, for God's sakes, you know, African Americans who have lived their entire lives here are forced to assimilate if they want to ascend to the top of their class. They want to ascend to the top of the ladder within whatever profession they're going in. They have to, you know what I'm saying, there's this pressure. They don't have to, but there's this strong pressure to assimilate. And that assimilation, when we look at the divisions within our communities, and I think you're referring to black and brown, I think you're referring to, you know, indigenous Americans those of us who are of African ancestry, we see these divisions that exist today, where, you know, oftentimes, not at all, but not all the time, because the media doesn't show you the solidarity. I mean, because there's a lot of different solidarity within different communities throughout the U.S. where you see the black and Latino solidarity in full effect, in full action. But to be honest, there are also members within both communities that have bought into the hype about, you know, and have started to point the finger of blame to one another. And so they don't look at the fact that this pie has been cut, and the people that have the largest piece of the pie are those who are of European ancestry, white people in the U.S. And they have the biggest piece of the pie. But then you look at the 15% of Latinos and the 13% of African Americans, and we're giving the crumbs. We're given the crumbs, and for some reason, you know, we know what the reasons are. We've been trained not to think critically of certain things, But we scurry for these crumbs like little mice, and then start to point fingers and say, oh, they're taking our jobs, or oh, they're, you know what I'm saying, they're taking our jobs, and this, that, and the other, and not taking a second saying, listen, look how big their piece of the pie is. Look how big the white folks' piece of the pie is. You know, let us, you know what I'm saying, come together in solidarity on a massive scale, on a mass scale, and let us put pressure and let us demand, not request, but demand. I mean, I'm done with this requesting crap. I'm talking about demanding that we get our, you know what I'm saying, our piece of the pie. And with these demands, we have to be serious. It means that we don't vote for these ridiculous, you know, Democrats. You know, we certainly don't vote for these Republicans, but we certainly don't vote for these Democrats that are dressed up and saying, oh, we're going to do this, that, and the other, and we need to get out of this illusion that the Democratic Party is some kind of progressive party that is going to emancipate and going to bring us closer to equality, whether we're black or Latino. We need to get off that high horse, you know, except for a couple Democrats, you know, within their respective party or irrespective party, by and large, they go the way of the corporation. And when we talk about corporation, we talk about looking at the term fascism, which, you know, by Mussolini and other people's definition, fascism, you know, in essence, is the merger between the state and the corporation. And I want to play this bar clip that kind of highlights, you know, how America can definitely, without a doubt, be considered a fascist state right now. And it's a fascist state that it continues to reap havoc and wreak havoc upon poor community after poor community. And until we wake up and realize that America and those that control the major institutions within America, education, politics, labor, obviously government, education, until we wake up and realize those elite few that control America do not have our best interests in sight in any shape, form, or fashion, and that they are being controlled willingly by the corporations that line their pockets so that they can run for re-election and they can accept these largesse and all these different trips and junkets across the world, we're going to continue to see what is going on, okay? And so I want to play this bar clip, and then I'll get Peter and Maria's comments afterwards. And like I said, anytime anyone wants to call in, please, you're more than welcome to call in. This show is as much the people who listen to this show and the people who will listen to the show as it is mine and Peter's and Maria's. So please call in at any point. Your take is definitely welcomed.
For more than 40 years, the left has been sounding alarms about the United States' imminent descent into fascism. And there have indeed been fascists at every level and in every branch of U.S. government. One can even make the case, as I often do, that during the long period of Jim Crow, the southern states fit nearly all the usual definitions of a fascist regime. At various times and places, America has teetered on the brink of fascism, or experienced episodes that certainly felt like fascism to those who lived through them. With the Supreme Court's recent decision upholding laws against providing what is called material support to terrorists, the national criminal justice system is now set to operate as a recognizably fascist political machine. 6 of the 9 justices endorsed the government's definition of what constitutes material support for groups it deems terroristic, including a civil rights activist's attempt to draw a Kurdish resistance organization into a nonviolent dialogue with its Turkish adversaries. The High Court majority essentially ruled that mere interaction with those branded terrorists is a serious crime, no matter what one's intentions. It is criminal to give such groups any advice whatsoever, even if the advice is to find nonviolent means of reaching their political goals. The new law of the land is thou shalt not talk to or appear in any way supportive of those who the U.S. government has proclaimed terrorists. It appears to be settled law that the United States can label opponents of its allies abroad, Turks, Israelis, Pakistanis, Indians, whoever, as terrorists, even when their activities are not directed against the United States. Nelson Mandela and other South African freedom fighters remained on a State Department terrorist list until just 2 years ago, which is a useful historical point. We can safely say that the U.S. is much closer to fascism now under Barack Obama than it was under President Ronald Reagan 30 years ago. Back then, the Reagan regime embraced the white minority government in South Africa. Yet, even though Mandela and his African National Congress were on a U.S. terror list, no American citizen was punished for actively supporting the ANC. Ronald Reagan and his crowd may have been fascists. I think they were. But the mechanisms of law were not in place to allow them to rule like fascists. Since 2001, the fascists that have long been among us have been allowed to perfect their judicial, legislative, and executive machinery of state power and to dismantle legal barriers to actual fascist rule. Next month, in New York City, a people's lawyer and civil liberties heroine, Lynn Stewart, faces resentencing on her conviction of giving material support to her client, who was marked as a terrorist. Federal prosecutors, that means Barack Obama's prosecutors, want to increase Lynn Stewart's 28-month sentence to decades in prison, a death sentence for a woman of her age and health. When all the people's lawyers are gone, and Lynn Stewart is among the last, then so effectively is the rule of law, and all our talk about the definition of fascism will be moot. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And before we go to comments from Peter and Maria, we have actually a caller on the line, and I want to pass them through. Caller, you're on live on Your World News. Caller?
Hello?
Yes, you're on live.
Hello. Greetings. This
greetings.
Sabrina. Can you hear me?
Yeah, a little bit of feedback. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. I wanted to point out that, first off, you know, yesterday, the so-called celebrated 4th of July, like Frederick Douglass said, Mumia Abu-Jamal had, in the 1990s, put his book out, Life and Death Row, and used that quote, what to the slave is the 4th of July. So every year at the Liberty Bell, or the site around there, in Philadelphia, is a march. That is also about the 1st of July was when Mumia was sentenced. So that's a point to make a anniversary to have a march there up in Philadelphia for Mumia. And this year with Obama and Holder being there, and plus there was a memorial for African ancestors that was supposed to be put in place, that gave another focus.
Right.
So that included Immortal Technique to be there, as well as MOVE and many other people from, you know, all around that came out. But very interesting that we're talking about this today, as this is the Independence Day for Venezuela, July 5th.
Right.
3 years ago, I was there in Venezuela, and actually, I think it was 4 years ago now that I think of it now. Well, it was a couple of years ago. And it was a tremendous celebration, not necessarily one of the firecrackers and that, but to commemorate the big liberator, which is Simon Bolivar, who learned his lesson of independence and struggle from the slaves when he went to Haiti. And he took that back with the goal of liberating all of Latin America. But that didn't happen. So Later on in the years, it did happen, you know, for like Venezuela and such as that. So even for all the different parties there in Venezuela, whether they're Chavinista or not, they're all celebrating the acknowledging the liberator Simon Bolivar. So that we need to keep focus of that. The people of Mexico had let me know when I was at the labor exchange last year, and then also was pointed out that the U.S. Social Forum that was in Detroit, the people from Venezuela, that there were, is to be a conference on July 22nd through 24th in Caracas, Venezuela, which I plan on attending. And it's called Nuestra America. Ideally, what this was to focus on this situation, particularly those of Mexico, with FAIS organization, is the plight of immigrants, as well as the workers in the trade unions. Because of Hurricane Alex, it's in question whether that organization will be there in Caracas, but of course, the weather people will be representative, ideally, hopefully they can be there. And there's something that needs to be also talked to about that. But first off, the invitation with at the U.S. Social Forum was including for everyone to go for this Nuestra America conference. And I'm sure perhaps people can explain more of the ideal of Nuestra America, which means that another America is possible. That's the main focus of that. And this is going from the writings of someone, I believe, in the 1800s, 1900s. Of looking, you know, what was happening with imperialism in Latin America, and that idealist struggle takes place now. So, but another alarm came off over the weekend. We know about with the conspirator of Posada Carriles that was found to be trying to sneak into Venezuela.
Yeah.
And what was his intentions and what was he trying to do? I mean, you know, obviously they were expecting that it was something bigger of damage control, possibly maybe even an attack on Chavez himself or, you know, other, you know, something like that. So the parties that he was trying to meet there are also being sought out. But the thing that is really of concern, and as we're seeing full circle happening here this weekend, is as we've been talking about with the BP oil, we talk about the effects that are here in the States, but we don't talk about what it is to Central America, Mexico, to Cuba, and such as that, meaning if all the claims and the money is spent here, what are those people going to get to help with that? And with Hurricane Alex, the impact of what it is to Mexico, obviously that does have an effect there, with the BP oil spill of what the damage that they're receiving there. So I want to point that out there as a way possible. But as we look to Latin America, and hence since last week with Oliver Stone's movie South of the Border coming out, gives us another answer that we can look to instead of just saying, you know, miserable about with U.S. imperialism, about seeing that there's another way, another avenue to bring forth. And so, you know, that I wanted to, you know, add that to the voice of the concern today as we look to, you know, the so-called Independence Day here in Babylon,
right,
and also what it is as in effect as in, you know, Latin America, such as Colombia,
yeah,
Venezuela, Cuba, Central America, and such as like that. They are seeing another way, and as with the film that Oliver Stone put out, South of the Border, really shows that that is out there.
Right, those are great points you bring up. And before you go, if you can tell us, since you said that you were in Venezuela not too long ago, with all the misinformation and disinformation that's being put out there about Chavez and about the fact that the people are living, under a dictatorship, and we know that's not true. But so many of us haven't been to Venezuela. What did you notice when you were in Venezuela? And what are some of the things that you appreciated about Venezuelan society that you would hope that, you know, one day we could actually see some of those things in American so-called democracy?
The interesting and key point with Venezuela, and what I have mentioned before with hip-hop revolution, which is basically their inspiration is Chavez. They got the tools to set up their radio stations and put forth hip-hop in the community. So as we saw Revolution die here in the States, it's being uprooted and expanded there in Latin America. And so the collective, as they're known now, of Venezuela, Caracas, and, you know, the country there expanded to where they, you know, the tools that they had to going out to Argentina, to Colombia, to having a summit each year. And it got beyond the summit where they're going out and, you know, such as like doing work in Haiti, Cuba, gone to Puerto Rico, connecting with the Boricuans there and, you know, with their focus of that, you know, the Puerto Rico is not Puerto Rico, it's Boricua. And, you know, the independent struggle that is there and, you know, their message of hip-hop that is there. And so it's expanded there. But ideally, the remarkable thing of it was is in this country and such elsewhere as we think, and when we think of those that are in revolution, we think of the older 40, 50, 60, 70, you know, whatever that, you know, that people at this age here in this country look at as past tense. That is not the case in Venezuela.
Right.
It's the youth. It's the 18, 17, 19, 20-something years old. No, you know, there's some 30-something year olds that are there. And then quite interesting there in Venezuela and Argentina is a school of hip-hop. So, you know, and going to that school and going to the radio station that they have there, you saw that the youth, meaning kids, elementary in there, were the next generation that were being schooled and being creative on their ideas of revolution, keeping the focus. So for Venezuela, the interesting is Chavez bringing into power brought back in the majority of the people to have a voice, meaning those that are Afro-Venezuelans and indigenous, which obviously he is acknowledging claims that he is. And he gave them that representation. So, you know, we hear all this stuff like, you know, they're trying to, you know, say that, you know, oh, we got to, you know, Chavez is the negative and he's got to be out because of the just like Cuba, the rich that were without are voicing their concern and want to see it gone. But it lives on, you know, even further, you know, and that's the case. Like, for example, their last elections, there was some province and some governors that got of the opposition, maybe a couple of more in. So, you know, I had a concern of that, but the youth that was there that spoke to me, and this is the youth that said, Sabrina, this is not of concern because, you know, yes, they got a little head here, but obviously they got a little head there cheating if they could in the election, but it was still a fair election. But, you know, they used their means of trying to manipulate and, you know, using the Catholic Church and have people come out, you know, against, you know, with a negative on Chavez and spear that out. But the majority of the people, which is the, you know, the barrios and, you know, the parts and that are Afro-Venezuelan, stand for Chavez. And let it be the message to be with Chavez is that his message was not only just his, and it is a democracy. It's not a Democrat, a dictator. But the fact of him listening to the people of, you know, the barrios and of their concerns of, you know, when the 80s, and the 70s when they were without. And so a perfect example was the coup that took place. This is the only coup that you can look on the internet and see what took place, see the youth there that's saying that, oh, no, we're not going back. We're standing up here and we're demanding that Chavez be put in back in office. So that coup ended within days. You know, that was April, I think, was it 2003, 2004? I might be wrong on the year. But that is the one place that happened. Now, if we had did that with our elections here when with Bush stole the election twice, we probably would have a different outcome as of it is today. But these are the people that took the courage, and what you saw there, you saw that these were the youth. When you look at these videos and Google on and find out about with the coup that took place in April, you know, against Chavez, you see that the people that were fighting, the people that were having the voice there, were the youth. And so that is one thing that gives an encouragement, you know, today, you know, because I've just celebrated my Earth Day. And I'm not getting a spring chicken. I'm getting 50-something years old. There's others older than me, 60, 70 and that. As we know we've got political prisoners that are in jail that are in their 50s to 70s.
Right.
And it seems like as they try to put the stereotype here, the revolution has died out here. But there
right.
in Latin America, it's very much alive, and especially there in Cuba and Venezuela. And I have to say, we even also with Colombia, because when I went to the summit in Venezuela, were some artists that were from Colombia that, you know, are using their voice to bring about change, you know, in their
right.
country. So it's not all gloom and everything as we're seeing with Venezuela, Bolivia, as we're seeing with the climate change conference that took place where Evo Morales is using his voice to have a declaration to put in place that, you know, can be presented and voted by people outside of having to be at a summit, a conference of the leaders, to put in place that, look, this is what the world's people want in place, to see a declaration for climate change at the UN. And he's asking us our participation, to sign a petition to put our numbers right there for the United Nations to see there in that visibility.
Right. Yeah, those are excellent points. And thank you so much for calling in, Sabrina. I really appreciate your perspective. And that's because it's not often we have somebody that calls in that has actually been to those places. And I know you've been to Cuba as well. So I really appreciate you calling in and continue to light the fires. And you're right. There is so much revolution that's going on in the hearts of young folks, you know, throughout, you know, places like throughout Latin America as well as other places, and they just simply don't get any kind of recognition on the corporate media, and you know, given what the corporate media is, you know, why would we expect them to? So that's why I appreciate you putting that information out there and the work that you've continued to do for a long, long, long time now. So thank you so much for calling in.
And thank you. And I have to clarify, I haven't been to Cuba yet. I'm afraid if I go to Cuba, I may not come back. Like a lot of our friends. There's so much work to be done here. And then for Hip Hop Revolution, it's hiphoprevolution.org on Facebook. They have a link out where, you know, you can get on board there. And much as I hate Facebook, I had to get on board and sign on there so I can keep in the link with our comrades. And it's
right.
open to everyone, you know, as for that.
Right. All right. Thank you so much. The hiphoprevolution.org.
Yes, on Facebook. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Facebook.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Stay blessed.
All right. Be blessed, you too. You know, Sabrina brought up a good point, is that the information is on there on the web. You know, folks that are listening right now, if you just go to Google and then click on video. The Revolution It Will Not Be Televised is online, and I believe Venezuela Rising is on. But I know for sure that The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which was a documentary that was made about the coup, and it was these Irish filmmakers came, and they didn't know, they had no idea that the coup was gonna go down as it did. And just by chance, since they were there and they had their cameras there, they were able to actually catch the coup and the plot to overthrow, you know, Chavez's government. And it's really, really interesting. I mean, and very powerful to see where even the young soldiers just had an about face and they said, "Nah, we're not down with this." And if it wasn't for them, you know, who knows where Chavez would be? But they had an about face and released him, and the rest is history. So, Peter, you've talked about fascism a lot in the past. You know, dare I say, America is a fascist state, yes or no?
Absolutely, a resounding yes to that question. And, you know, there's such a misunderstanding of what fascism really is, what the word means, what the concept is. You know, how much have we heard, you know, in the mainline media lately about, you know, Obama, the Obama administration being socialist and being fascist? Well, you know, that's an oxymoron. It's like, you know, you can't be socialist and fascist at the same time. It's the same type of ignorance and hypocrisy where people were calling him, they're complaining about his radical Christian pastor, and then in the next breath they'd say mistakenly, of course, that Obama was a Muslim. Not that it matters, obviously, whether he's a Muslim or Christian or a Jew to be the president of the United States. But at any rate, yes, the United States is a fascist state. And a better word that I like to use instead of fascism, or to break down what fascism is, because fascism, you know, as we know it as a political operative, you know, beginning in the early 20th century, primarily in Italy and in Germany, and the word that Benito Mussolini, who was the dictator in Italy, who oversaw Italian fascism, I mean, he said it best, that the best English word for the derivative of that Italian term would be to talk about corporatism. And if we look at what the United States really is, it is a corporate state. You know, this nation, this society, politically and socially, is really run by the corporate powers that be. And what that means is, you know, we're really not a democracy. And that's one of the things that we have, you know, we've got to point that out on this so-called Independence Day, that the United States is not a democracy. And what it is, in fact, it's a plutocracy. And plutocracy means a rule by the rich, or an oligarchy, the rule by the few. We could call it an oligarchic plutocracy. And, you know, so it's a rule by a small number of elite people, of wealthy elite people, and who have an inordinate amount of influence from their seats in the corporate world, from the seats of power on Wall Street and so forth. And so that is, by definition, a fascist state. So the United States is absolutely a fascist state, and it's not because of too much liberalism. If you're watching the mainline news and particularly Fox News, you might be thinking that, you know, the country is too liberal and so leaning towards fascism. Fascism is an inordinate amount of conservative ideology, and so the United States is uber conservative, and it's fascist. It's not a democracy. It is a plutocracy. And the fact is that capitalism has really long past run out of its usefulness. Capitalism now survives on fabricated bubbles, you know, the kind of things that come up, you know, periodically. It depends on bloated debt, both personal and corporate debt. It depends on military spending. That, you know, it borders on suicidal, the military spending in this country. And there's no, I mean, we, you know, that's a fact of the matter. I mean, you look at the United States and we see that capitalism depends on a recurring and now apparently constant and ongoing warfare to continue to look for more scarcer and scarcer resources, to look for markets that are further flung from the heart of the empire here in the States. And so, you know, capitalism by its very nature is predatory and destructive and militaristic. And so, absolutely, you know, this is a fascist state that is run by an elite few. And we've got to deconstruct and debunk the myth of democracy in this country. It is not a democracy. And not only is it not a democracy within the borders of the United States, but listening to the sister that just called in and her reference to Venezuela and the Venezuelan Independence Day and then the coup that was attempted to be carried out, fueled by the United States and the CIA, you know, we can look at the long sordid history of the United States government's interventions in the affairs of other countries and how the United States government has no regard for the independence and the freedom and the democracy of the peoples of other foreign nations. I mean, we can see that most explicitly now, obviously, in Iraq and Afghanistan, increasingly in Pakistan, in Yemen. We can see the U.S. Military is still occupying Haiti. And we can see that all over the world, and we can run down a laundry list of interventions and wars and police actions for the last over 100 years that the United States has been interfering with the democracy and the independence and the freedoms that, you know, this nation claims to hold so dear. They interfere with those very things in the lives of the people of other countries. So the hypocrisy there is just staggering, you know. And it was just a year ago. We just last week, I think the 1 year anniversary, or the 1 year observation rather, passed of the coup in Honduras, and the U.S. was behind that. So, you know, this is an ongoing thing, and we're not talking about just stuff in the past, but we're talking about things that are ongoing that make this nation, this state, a fascist state and an anti-democratic state. So we need to keep those things in mind, particularly on this so-called Independence Day holiday.
Exactly. 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 And you know, as Sabrina said, you know, there's a movie that was done by Oliver Stone that is it's a documentary, and it's called South of the Border, and it details the fact that there have been 40 some odd U.S. So-called interventions throughout Latin America. And it's you know, going back to, you know, as we know, you know, from our history, that the second U.S. intervention and overthrow of a government was that of the Guatemalan government in 1954 of Jacobo Arbenz, and that was fueled by, you know, you had everyone that had their hands in that, from Bernays to the U.S. government, you know, from Nixon. I only believe he was president at that time, but he had his he wasn't president at the time, but he had his hand in that. Chiquita, what we now know, that used to be called United Fruit Company, and now they're known as Chiquita. Chiquita. You know, we know that we eat the Chiquita bananas. We see the, you know, Chiquita symbol. But they used to be known, they used to be referred to as United Fruit. And it was about them being able to go in there and expropriate and just basically have a monopoly over acres, tons and tons and tons of acres of banana trees. And that's where you actually get the term Banana Republic. It's from that illegal U.S. takeover and throwing out a popular president, you know, known as Jacobo Arbenz. And he was very populist. He was very much in support of land reform, agrarian reform, and so that's all that stuff is covered within that documentary called South of the Border. So Google it, South of the Border, you know, Oliver Stone. It should be one of the first things that pops up. So I know this is close to home with you, Maria, you know, given the fact that you're from Latin America, and you know, I know you do a lot of mobilization around this, and you know, Peter talked about the military. We see the corporate interest that controls a major part of the military, and vice versa. And you know, we look at this DREAM Act, where so many people, so many Latinos are behind, but unfortunately, you know, so many Latinos are unaware, and I know that you're mobilizing around this to try to create workshops within the Latino community, so they know everything about the DREAM Act, that it's potentially good, but it shouldn't have that string attached to it, those strings attached to it, where it would mandate that you would have to do some kind of military service to the United States of America in order to be given, you know, amnesty, or to be given citizenship. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, you know, given everything that we've already talked about in terms of U.S. foreign policy and military involvement in Latin America, it wouldn't make any sense for us coming from our countries who were displaced from our nations to fight for a country who, you know, who invaded our nations and our sovereignty. It just doesn't make any sense. It's like during, you know, like Muhammad Ali would, you know, refuse to join the military for that same reason, that this nation does not represent, you know, the interests of his community, or, you know, it wasn't fighting for freedom for the African-American community here or abroad. It was, why are we here, you know, going to point the gun at other people of color who are being oppressed across the seas? And you know, in the end, the military is not going to do anything for us, and it's continuing to repress our own communities in Latin America. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, like Peter said, and I mentioned in the beginning, the Schools of America, that's in no way is that any form of spreading democracy. All the, you know, the Cold War, all these wars that the United States has continued to fight across the world, it's not about democracy. It's not about freedom. It's about, you know, ensuring that corporations are able to proceed with their agenda, and, you know, so that the elite and the oligarchy in this country can continue to reap the benefits of our nations. And it has nothing to do with freedom and democracy. So, I think that's yesterday when I see people, you know, just, it was ironic because I was watching people during the fireworks, and it's, everyone is just, like, so, you know, hypnotized and gazed. And it's exactly, like, how people are. They're just closed-minded and uneducated about what the U.S. is really doing. And, you know, there's people even screaming, like, oh, you know, the land of the home, the land of the brave and the home of the free, and, you know, people saying freedom and, like, being so happy to be American. And it, to me, it was just, like, it's just the most disgusting, ironic thing you could ever witness, because it has nothing to do with democracy or freedom. Even people in the U.S., like you've mentioned, aren't free. And I guess the last thing I want to say is, I believe it was in the 19th century, the poet José Martí said, you know, the irony of this entire situation is that immigrants end up in the belly of the beast. And, you know, and my message to a lot of Latino youth and just youth of color in this country is, like, if we're in the belly of the beast and we have this opportunity to mobilize where the policies are coming from, why aren't we doing that? Like, if you are in the belly of the beast, unfortunately, we had to end up here, why aren't we doing something to dismantle the beast?
Good point. Good, very excellent point. And just wanted to, I just got word from our producer that the website, you know, is hip hop. It's HIPHOPREVOLUCION.org. All right, that's the spelling. So make sure you spell it that way and not revolution, you know, in terms of spelling revolution the English way. You want to spell it hip hop, REVOLUCION.org. If you go to the other one, it's some Chris Brown, you know, USA stuff. So definitely want to go to that one, and you'll get a ton of information. And thanks to Sister Sabrina for providing us with that information. And so we've been talking about corporations. We've been talking about their nefarious grip on American society, and so many Americans don't know how these corporations dictate their day-to-day lives from, you know, Americans not being able to discern these dominant narratives that have been fed to them, to the influence that corporations have on elected officials, and we're supposed to be in this so-called representative democracy, but when you vote most of the time for a Democrat or Republican, when they get in office or they continue to be in office, they're not representing you. They are representing the corporations. They are representing the Cigna or the Blue Cross Blue Shield, or they're representing the defense industry, whether it's General Electric or Northrop Grumman or Lockheed Martin. Or they're representing so-called nonprofit organizations or these organizations, these nefarious organizations, otherwise known as like the NRA or AIPAC. And so we even see with AIPAC, and, you know, and how so many Americans are programmed to believe that the victim is actually the villain, and the villain is the victim, when we look at the Middle East. But the victim and the victims continue to be in the Middle East, you know, dating back to 1948, are the Palestinians, and not the people that live within, and not the people that control, I should say, the state of Israel, and also control the West Bank and Gaza. And those of us, you know, it may be hard to stomach, those of us who are of African ancestry, that some of our elected officials that are part of the Congressional Black Caucus are just not doing their damn job. They are influenced by major corporations as well. And we as black people, we out of anybody else, should appreciate the struggle of Palestinians, and we should be in solidarity with them, because we have seen this. We have seen this for, you know, well into 400 years, and if we just want to look at recent history, we've seen this within this you know, this fascist, you know, white supremacist, institutionally racist state, you know, otherwise known as USA. We've seen this in Zania, South Africa, with the apartheid regime. We know struggle, and so we need to wake the hell up and not be afraid of these lobbyists. And we need to put pressure on our elected officials and stand on the side of justice. And I want you to hear this this clip that was on Barr, Black Agenda Report, not too long ago.
Every objective observer of Black American grassroots political sentiment recognizes that African Americans are the most inclined of any major demographic group to empathize with the plight of Palestinians. It is an historic and contemporary fact that is consistent with Black America's special identification with the downtrodden and dispossessed of the world. This relative pro-Palestinian bent in the Black American worldview flows from obvious and formative facts of the Black experience in the United States, which has led Black people to put the highest premium on social justice. That's why Blacks can sing about Moses and the Promised Land all day long on Sunday and still feel that the people currently in charge in Israel are on the wrong side of justice. Since at least the mid-60s, many Jewish organizations have treated Black sympathies for the Palestinian people as rank anti-Semitism of the kind Jews experienced at the hands of whites. In some Jewish circles, it is accepted as a truism that Blacks are anti-Semitic. We see such perceptions today in the willingness of some to believe that even Barack Obama is somehow out to get Israel, despite his groveling support of the Israeli regime's barbaric behavior since his election. Over the years, the relentless pressures of the Israel lobby have succeeded in causing most Black elected officials to cower in fear of being labeled anti-Israel. Black officeholders now typically embark on periodic, pitiful pilgrimages to the Jewish state, bowing symbolically to Jerusalem so as not to be marked as sympathetic to Palestinians. And on the floor of the U.S. Congress, the Black Caucus shames itself and misrepresents its constituents by endorsing every fawning resolution promulgated by Israel's operatives in the United States. Two Black congresspersons, Barbara Lee of California, the caucus chair, and Minnesota's Keith Ellison, one of two Muslim members of the House, recently wrote a letter to President Obama saying they were deeply troubled by the military action aboard the aid flotilla en route to Gaza, resulting in the death of 9 civilians, including one American. Representatives Lee and Ellison requested that Obama support a thorough investigation and that he call for a lifting of the blockade on Gaza. Yet even this exceedingly mild letter is apparently too risky for the rest of the 42-member Black Caucus to sign. Back in January of 2009, as Israel was massacring more than 1,300 Palestinian men, women, and children, and President-elect Obama stood shamefully silent, only two Black Caucus members, Maxine Waters of California and Gwen Moore of Wisconsin, had the courage to vote against a House resolution vilifying the Palestinian victims. Barbara Lee and Keith Ellison were among the 7 members that sought neutral ground by simply voting present, while the bulk of the Black Caucus behaved as if they represented some Arab-hating constituency in Utah. Clearly, the Black Caucus is collectively terrified of the Israel lobby. The bigger the Black Caucus gets, the less representative it becomes of Black America and its desire for global social justice. But that's all right. Tel Aviv is pleased. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So, Pia, this is where I want you to come in, because we you know, it is about, it's about justice right now, and so I want you, someone who has been to seminary school, and I know that, you know, you have had a lot of internal struggles yourself in terms of where you've evolved in terms of how you look at religion and how you look at Christianity right now, the mass indoctrination that goes on within so many churches throughout not just the U.S. but throughout the world, and by and large, I mean, that indoctrination is the perfect word, because indoctrinating indigenous peoples throughout the Western Hemisphere and indoctrinating enslaved Africans was, you know, that was part and parcel, part of the name of the game to continue the institution of chattel slavery, and to also continue to expropriate land, precious land, and to enslave and to beat and to oppress indigenous folks all the way down from Argentina all the way through Canada, you know, and beyond. You mentioned it when we first started. This just piece right here, the injustices and the murders and the brutality that has gone on throughout the Middle East. And I say that because, you know, it's such a coveted, holy place. Palestine. It's a very, very coveted, holy place. And so much injustice goes on. And the Bible has been used to even convert many Christians to be Zionists. And we know Zionism is not a religion. It's, you know, so you can be a Christian Zionist, you can be a Jewish Zionist. What are your thoughts on that? And can you also talk about what you mentioned when we first started the show, the indoctrination of religion, you know, specifically even looking at Christianity?
Yeah, of course. I think it's crucial for our conversation today. And Glenn mentioned how, in church on Sundays, particularly black Christians can sing about Moses and delivering the Hebrew people, the predecessor of today's nation state of Israel, because it's, you know, the same geopolitical area and so forth. But and then on Monday, turn around and critique Zionism. And I wish that were the case universally within this country. But unfortunately, there is a grossly distorted understanding of the relationship between, you know, the people of Israel in the Bible and the state of the modern nation state of Israel, particularly in today's conversations about world politics, and particularly Christians, because so many Christians, particularly fundamentalist evangelical Christians, have such a warped and distorted view, an ahistorical view, and an uncritical understanding of the nation state, the modern nation state of Israel. And so what we see in much of Christianity, and you can turn on some of the shows and some of these, see so many of these jackleg so-called preachers talking about the necessity of a conflagration in the Middle East that involves Israel in order to eventuate in the second coming of Christ. And so what that means is they are looking forward, they're egging on nations of the state of Israel to start a war in the Middle East. And the way that's playing out now is with Iran. So many evangelical and fundamentalist Christians are hoping that Iran will attack Israel, because, of course, if Iran attacks Israel, then the United States will run to the defense of Israel. But it will just invoke this, you know, basically World War III, and what they are and what they're hoping, the war to end all wars, but the wars, a war to end history, to usher in the second coming of Christ. And it is obviously just, it's ludicrous on its face, and we've got to dismiss that kind of thinking. First of all, we've got to understand that kind of thinking, that kind of Christian Zionism, is not rare at all, but it's a very common ideology within the Christian church in America, and we've got to recognize that kind of poisonous doctrine and debunk it and challenge it, because that, obviously, that's just deadly and it's dangerous. It's absolute madness to try to egg on nations to attack other nations for some kind of, you know, end times superstition. So we need to understand that, be very clear about that, that there is a gross misinterpretation of the biblical record and a misunderstanding of what it means to support the modern nation state of Israel, because you see that so often, and it's particularly disturbing when you have black Christians, because there's also a lot of black Christians who are evangelical and even fundamentalist. And so they're not only are they not in solidarity with the Palestinians, but they are also hoping for some kind of conflagration in the Middle East that will bring about this war, end time. Armageddon is the war. You know, that concept of this battle for the end of the end of history is Armageddon is a popular word that's used. And so you even see that with black American Christians hoping for the swift coming of Armageddon so that Christ can return and bring history to an end and usher in some kind of utopian kingdom here. Obviously, that's a lot of madness. It's a lot of nonsense. And we have to, you know, for those who still wish to maintain their Christian identity and claim a religious affiliation, but still need to, you know, can embrace that, but yet still need to understand how that is such a poisonous misinterpretation and misunderstanding of Scripture, and a gross, totally inadequate understanding of current political situations. So that right there in itself is a just a deadly thing and a disastrous thing, and it's a really good example of the role of the conflation of religion with nationalism, and how it makes such a deadly mix of ignorance, of stupidity, of xenophobia, of racism, and we need to be aware of that. We need to break it down. So understand that why so many Christians are pro-Israel. You know, it's because of this end times madness, this superstition about the connection between the current state of Israel and some kind of future utopia with the coming of Christ. It is absolute madness, and it doesn't have a leg to stand on in terms of theologically. Biblically, it doesn't have a leg to stand on. So it's ludicrous whether you look at it from a secular perspective and just have concerns, you know, politically and socially for the human race. It's ridiculous if you look at it from a religious standpoint and try to talk about it in terms of biblical text. It's absolute madness. It needs to be dismissed, debunked, and utterly thrown away. So that is probably one of the most deadly evidences of this mix of nationalism and religion in this country. And you know, it's funny that you know this country, so many people think that this is one nation under God. I mean, how many people have seen churches just this weekend, you know, leading up to this Independence Day holiday, that have, you know, on their marquee or a banner or somewhere, "One Nation Under God"? You know, churches kind of like swell up a little bit this time of year because they feel a particular affinity to their nationalism, because they believe that this nation of the United States is some kind of special and unique country. And that goes back to many of the founding fathers. Now, it's not true to say that this is a Christian nation in terms of it having been founded by Christians or founded in order to be a biblical nation. That is also madness. That is also ahistorical ignorance and just flatly untrue. You know, this was certainly not, there was no intention whatsoever of any kind of theocratic rule by any of the founders. And so we need to dismiss that quickly too, and challenge any of the biblicists and any of the fundamentalists who still hold on to that madness. So we've got to dismiss that. But we need to look at some of the thoughts of some of the founders, you know, and look at the hypocrisy of what they were saying. For example, quote from John Adams, the second president, the first vice president. He said, "Our Constitution was made only for moral and religious people." What kind of madness is that? I mean, at the time that he said that, at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, most of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were slave owners. You know, several of the first presidents, those who were citizens of the southern states, they were slave owners. So to say that the Constitution was for moral people is laughable, utterly laughable. You know, and it would be pure comedy if it weren't so tragic, because the fact that human beings were enslaved to those individuals in the numbers of hundreds. And so another quote, Ben Franklin says, "Only a virtuous people are capable of freedom." I'd like to know what kind of virtues Benjamin Franklin was thinking about when he thought about the American people and you know, the fact that it was a slave nation at the time. I'd like to know what kind of morality John Adams was talking about when he talked about this Constitution is only made for moral and religious people. What kind of morality were those founders and those individuals thinking about when they used those kind of words? And there's other members of that era, Daniel Webster, James Madison, who were saying things like, it's impossible to look back at the events of the Revolution of the 1770s and 1780s, and the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the drafting of the Constitution. They say things like, it's impossible to look at those events and fail to see the hand of God, the hand of the Almighty. Well, you know, that is if you're on the side of the winners. It's very easy for wealthy white landowners and slave owners to have that perspective. And then you contrast that with the perspective of Malcolm X and the clip that he played. You know, it's not an American dream. It's an American nightmare. It's not some pious and religious and super moral people that founded this nation. And it's the same mess. We're in the same mess with the same type of people who are running this nation now. I mean, the founding of this nation was only possible because of the annihilation, the systematic annihilation and extermination of the natives on this continent. And then, also, as most of you know, the founders also believed that there was some kind of what they called manifest destiny, that God Almighty deemed it His will that the European unsettlers, the European intruders, would expand their intrusion all the way to the Pacific, which obviously they did eventually, all the way to California and then eventually up into Alaska. And so there was this conviction that God's hand was in this. And that's one of the most dangerous mythologies that we need to debunk, this time of year especially. We need to dismiss that. We need to say, no way. Forget it. That's just not true. That's absolutely not true. And it's utter madness. One of my favorite theologians by the name of James Cone, the author of Black Theology, one of my favorite quotes from Dr. Cone goes like this: as long as white people believe that God is on their side, there is no limits to the amount of violence that they will perpetrate. And we see that. We see that year in and year out, not just since the founding of this nation in 1776, but all the way back to when the first Europeans landed on this continent back in the 16th century. And so we need to look at those things. We need to look through the lenses of history and through the lenses of fact and through the lenses of reality when we look at what Independence Day is about, like Frederick Douglass did and like Malcolm X did, rather than look through these rose-colored glasses of imperialism and racism and white supremacy that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington used, and the kind of lenses that the right-wing conservative, racist, white nationalists use today. And not just those folks, but just regular folks who have been duped into believing that mythology, like Maria mentioned earlier. You know, just regular folks out in the streets and at parties and at picnics all throughout this weekend talking about, you know, God bless America and what a great nation. I mean, and the fireworks themselves. What do fireworks represent? They represent bombs and they represent missiles. They're representations of the violence and the warfare in which this nation was founded, and so I think that, you know, that's just it's an awful thing. I refuse to participate, you know, in Independence Day festivities. I refuse to attend any kind of fireworks displays because all of that stuff is really very obscene to me. It's very obscene to exalt that kind of militarism and that kind of institutionalized violence when it's literally killing people.
Yeah, you're right on, man. Right on. That's exactly. Yeah, I'm glad that you raised all those key points because, the hypocrisy within the words and the doctrines of the so-called founding fathers of what? Founding fathers of death, destruction, plunder. Those are what they were the founding fathers were. They were the founding of those things. They weren't the founding fathers of freedom, justice, liberty, and equality. At least, not if you were black or indigenous. You know, they certainly weren't the founding fathers of those things. And so, we have to repudiate them as much as we can, even though knowing that it's going to be vastly unpopular. I mean, whether it's in your classroom or when you're dialogue with friends, we have to repudiate and raise tough questions and raise tough tough comments, you know, among your circle of friends. And they was like, what are you talking about, you know? What are you talking about the Constitution in that way about, you know? But it's those tough questions. Be that inconvenient hero. Be that inconvenient hero. That's the only way where you can take this dialogue to another place where you can actually start, where if people actually, you know, take umbrage to what you're saying about America and its Constitution and the hypocrisy of American democracy, at least that raises the specter of consciousness, and then you can direct them to fact and all these different types of things that highlight your point, and they have the option either do the research their own or continue to be an ignorant zombie and continue to be manipulated by the machine. So I totally agree. You know, the bombs bursting air and the rockets' red glare. I mean, those are all kinds of things. And you know, in the song, you know, God bless America, and I'm proud to be an American. You know, oftentimes people don't even take a critical examination into the lyrics of some of these words. I mean, of some of these songs that are perpetuated during the seventh inning stretch of baseball games to the beginning of football and basketball games to halftime, all these types of things. And a lot of times, you know, halftime of these basketball games and football games, you know, there'll be black and brown skin faces. They'll bring out a Tamia, or they'll bring out a Keisha Cole or somebody else that will be singing these songs. And it's just weird. It's just crazy. To me, it's like weird where I see these black men, you know, with their hand over their heart, you know, at the beginning of a basketball game, and just like, you know, and even mouthing the words of the national anthem. I'm like, man, brother, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was just wish I could just get them and put them in a room and say, listen, it's a lie. And it's funny that, you know, the players such as Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who used to play, formerly known as Chris Jackson, when, you know, he played for the Denver Nuggets and a couple other teams. But when he took the stance that he was not going to get up and he was not going to sing or stand for the national anthem at the beginning of his NBA games, he was blacklisted. Or I would like to say, let me just rephrase that. He was whitelisted. And never got back into the league again. He was pushed out of the league and never got back into the league again. So, you know, good points, Peter. And we have about 12 minutes left, and I want to play this clip and then let you know you and Maria share your final thoughts. But I really want this last clip to enter the mind's eye of our listeners, because when we talk about the death penalty and you know, and obviously we know the U.S., especially various states, love the death penalty. When we talk about the death penalty and the killing of individuals, and oftentimes we see, you know, some of those individuals were actually innocent, after the fact with DNA, and we see Brother Troy Davis in Georgia right now fighting for his life, and other people fighting to preserve his life and for justice, you know, to enter the courtroom so this brother can be freed, because there's just now just a lot of evidence that he did not commit the crime they say he did. But this country kills people for taking the lives of other folks and for adversely impacting the lives of other people, usually one person or sometimes, unfortunately, a family or something like that. But when we look at these corporations, well, how come corporations can't receive the same kind of death penalty? Why can't they receive the same death penalty that human beings receive? You know? So anyways, I'm going to play this clip. We have about 11 minutes left, and I'll get very, very quick comments from Peter and from Maria to close out the show. But think about this. I think corporations should have the death penalty put to them where they're no longer in existence, where they can't they can no longer commit heinous crimes, such as Bechtel did outside the U.S. in Bolivia, privatizing water and rainwater. And this is a San Francisco area-based corporation. Come on, people. We got to wake up.
Over the last 100 or so years, corporations have gained many of the rights previously accorded only to human beings. Corporations have the right to buy and sell anything or anyone that can be bought or sold. Corporations have claimed the right to lie in their advertising and PR as free speech, along with the right to assist us mere humans in choosing our judges and elected officials with unlimited amounts of cash, including anonymous cash. Corporations have been awarded the right to patent the genetic sequences of diseases and to monopolize their cures, as well as patent rights to living plants and animals not of their invention. An entire new type of anti-pollution regulation called cap-and-trade actually enshrines a corporate right to pollute and establishes exchanges upon which speculators may bid, trade, and capture rents for those alleged rights. And unlike a working person who has no right to next month's, let alone next year's wages, legal scholars in the employ of corporations have devised and popularized something they call the regulatory takings doctrine, under which corporations may claim and recover from the government profits that they might have made in years to come. And let's not even talk about trillions in corporate welfare for banks, for military contractors, for Walmart, and others. While many will argue that corporations have too many rights as it is, this might be a good time to extend them at least one more right, a right which we humans have kept for ourselves up until now, the right to be put to death for serious crimes. Right now, federal statutes alone offer humans more than 40 different ways to earn the death penalty, including kidnapping, treason, aircraft hijacking, espionage, and many varieties of murder, conspiracy, threatening to murder, and even some drug crimes. Individual states offer the death penalty, too, for a host of similar offenses. Putting bad corporate actors down, the way we do rabid dogs and serial killers, is not a new or even a particularly radical idea. Corporations are, after all, created by the charters of individual states, so states do have the power to revoke them. Early in this country's history, corporate charters used to limit a company's existence to a set number of years, to confine its operations to manufacturing a certain item, to building a specific road or canal, and to prohibit the company from changing ownership, from dumping or concealing its assets, or engaging in other kinds of business. These are legal powers that our governments have not used in a long, long time, but which it's high time to reclaim. Homicidal profit-seeking on the part of corporations has become an everyday fact of modern life. Whether it's employers cutting health and safety corners, marketers pushing unsafe drugs, food, and products of all kinds, or the deadly industrial fouling of the planet's air, soil, oceans, and climate, we are living in the midst of a corporate crime wave of murderous and epic proportions. If we value human life, it only makes sense to treat corporate serial killers like, well, corporate serial killers, to confiscate their ill-gotten assets, to revoke their corporate charters, and to sentence the artificial personae of corporate malefactors to death. If corporations are legal persons, it's time to enforce some personal responsibility upon them with a corporate death penalty. After we accomplish that, it'll be time to think about extending a little of that same personal responsibility to the actual humans who operate behind the legal shield of corporations. But right now, as the saying goes, a corporation can't even get arrested in this country, which, come to think of it, might be another right which we humans ought to bestow upon them. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon. Find us on the web at www.blackagendareport.com.
So, Peter, last comments, and then Maria.
All right, thank you. You mentioned the brother that played basketball. who wouldn't participate in some of the nationalistic nonsense before games, and how difficult it is to watch black men who you know put their hands over their hearts and sing the songs and say the pledge and so forth. Yeah, I just wanted to share that, you know, I've never done any of that stuff, and I was almost put out of my high school commencement ceremony because I refused to do those things. Of course, they couldn't do that. So I was the only one in my graduating class that refused to stand up and do those things. And even to this day, if I go to a sporting event, I refuse to stand up. I don't take my hat off if I'm wearing one, you know, those kind of things. And I receive, you know, I get a lot of questions. I get a lot of looks. I get a lot of ridicule sometimes. But I stand firm in my principles. And I say that because, you know, everybody's listening can do those things. That's one way to resist is to just not participate in those nationalistic rituals. So if there's anything we can take away from today, it's, you know, don't participate in those things. Refuse to say the pledge. Refuse to sing those songs and encourage other people to resist in that fashion.
Definitely. Thank you. Any last words, Maria?
I guess going off of the clip we just heard, you know, something that's always really interesting to me is that touching on police brutality, like, any, you know, if you steal something in the hood, you can get beat, attacked, arrested, all types of abuses. But a corporation, you know, for money laundering or any other type of, you know, exploitation of their workers, numerous things that they do that are illegal will get a slap on the wrist, if that, you know, house arrest maybe, if they even get indicted, or, you know, they'll never be attacked publicly and abused like our communities are for things that, you know, are just not even comparable to the types of crimes that they're committing. So I just think it's interesting to think about that and how, I mean, that speaks a lot to the justice in this country.
Definitely. And, you know, I appreciate everyone that tuned in. If you're tuning in right now live, and I see there's a lot of folks that tuned in today, and we really appreciate your support. Please, the best way you can support this program is by supporting, is to take the link, blogtalkradio.com/your-world-news, and send it out to all of your networks. Please send it out to you. We keep saying this, send it out to you. All of your networks the same way. Sometimes we send out those ridiculous chain emails, you know. Please, this is knowledge is power, information is power, and this is a way that we can all share information and knowledge with one another. We all have something to learn, you know, just like when Sabrina called in today. We all learned something from that sister when she called in. And so it's not just about us disseminating information to you guys. It's about you guys coming on the show, calling in, and disseminating information to ourselves as well as all the listeners who will listen to the show live and who will listen to this archived. And so we have to continue to press and ask those tough questions and to raise the tough tidbits of information that counter so much of what we've been indoctrinated with. And so right now, you know, despite all the potential that this country has, it falls far beneath the line in terms of what anyone would want to see, not just for a democracy, but a place where human beings, you know, of all different races and cultures and creeds are respected on the same level. And that's not in America, and that is not in America. So those of you who are listening that are black and brown, that are dispossessed, that are poor whites, you need to wake up, all right? This country is, right now, cares much more about its corporate interests and its monopoly of power and wealth than it does you. And until you wake up, you can expect your kids, as well as yourself, but your kids and your grandkids to inherit the same kind of systematic oppression that you and your family has felt for generations. Wake up. So this song, is called Uncle Sam Goddamn, and it's by Brother Ali. It's called Uncle Sam Goddamn. If I sound mad, I am. And so this is Brother Ali, and this is dedicated to Uncle Sam. Next time, we'll see you on Your World News.
The name of this song is Uncle Sam Damn. show tune, but the show ain't ready for it. We're going to see if Tony Jerome and the band can maybe work it out for me. Straighten me out right quick. Nah, I like it so far, man. Yeah. Come on. Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the slave. Grand Imperial Guard, where the dollar is sacred and proud. Let's do the real, come on now. Smoke and mirrors, stripes and stars, stoning for the cross in the name of God. Bloodshed, genocide, rape and fraud, written to the pages of the law, good law. The cold continent latchkey child ran away one day and started acting foul. King of where the wild things are, daddy's proud, cause the Roman Empire done passed its town. Imported and tortured the workforce and never healed the wounds or shook the curse off. Now the grown-up Goliath nation holding open all distance for the part of David. Can you feel? Nothing can save you, you question the reign, you get rushed in and chained up. Fist raised, but I must be insane, cause I can't figure single damn way to change. Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the slave. The Grand Imperial Guard, where the dollar is sacred and power is God. Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the slave. The Grand Imperial Guard, where the dollar is sacred and power is God. All must bow to the fat and lazy. The obey me, and why do they hate me? Who me? Only two generations away from the world's most despicable slavery trade. Pioneered so many ways to degrade a human being that it can't be changed to this day. Legacy so ingrained in the way that we think we no longer need change to be slaves. Lord, it's a shameful display. The overseers even got raped along the way. Cause the children can't escape from the pain, and they born with the poison, the hatred in their veins. Try and separate a man from his soul, you only strengthen him and lose your own. But shoot that he walked near the throne. Remind him that this is my home. Now I'm gone. Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the slave. The Grand Imperial Guard, where the dollar is sacred and power is God. Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the slave. The Grand Imperial Guard, where the dollar is sacred. Hold up, give me one right here, hold up. You don't give money to the bums on the corner with a sign bleeding from their gums. Talking about you don't support a crackhead. What you think happens to the money from your taxes? The government's the addict with $1 billion a week kill brown people's habits. And even if you ain't on the front line, when Master yell crunch time, you right back at it. Man, look at how you hustling backwards. At the end of the year, add up what they subtracted. 3 out of 12 months, your salary pay for that madness. Man, that's a sadness. What's left? Get a big-ass plasma to see where they made Dan rather point the damn camera. Only approved questions get answered. Now stand your ass up for that national anthem. Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the slave. The Grand Imperial.